Let us pray. God, we come today to celebrate your beauty, to remind ourselves of your love and your greatest gift of us all, to us all, Jesus the Christ. Teach us his ways, let us hear his teaching so that we can be inspired to be like him. Amen. I love preaching on the parables. They're my favorite. For parables are kind of like jigsaw puzzles. They are hidden transcripts, which intentionally try to mislead and confuse Jesus' adversaries by appearing to say one thing while actually promoting something completely different. And because they are purposefully misleading, parables are some of the hardest of Jesus' teachings for us to hear, especially since our world resembles nothing like the worlds of the peasants of ancient Palestine. However, I must admit, our parable of this morning is one of Jesus' most perplexing, at least to me. There's a reason it only finds its way into Luke's gospel and not the rest. Sandwiched between two teachings on prayer, we get this. And he says, suppose one of you has a friend, and you go to him at midnight and say, friend, lend me 3 loaves of bread, for a friend of mine has arrived, and I have nothing to set before him. And he answers from within, do not bother me. The door has been locked, and my children are in bed. I cannot get up and give you anything. I tell you, even though he will not get up and give him anything because he is his friend, at least because of his persistence, he will get up and give him what he needs. The longer you dwell on this parable, the more confused you become. All week I found myself wrestling with a number of questions, like questions on friendship. Are we really to believe that a friend would not help another friend because his door was locked and his children in bed? It's one thing if the friend doesn't have any bread, but we are told that he does. Even more, what are we to make of the ultimate reason we are told that this friend helps? Persistence or annoyance? Is that friendship? More importantly, I can't help but wonder, what does this parable say about God? Since it's sandwiched between two teachings on prayer, many argue that this is Jesus teaching us about the importance of persistence in prayer. However, this raises a theological problem, at least to me. Is God like a parent in a candy store with a child that is persistently badgering God into submission? So the child only gets what she wants because of that persistence or annoyance? We've all been there more times than we'd like to admit. Perhaps I'm exaggerating a bit, but is God dependent on our persistence or our annoyance to come to our aid? I don't know about you, but that doesn't sit very well with me. So this morning I want to enter into our parable from the perspective of peasant society. A number of the details of our parable assumes the setting of a Galilean village. For example, the fact that the friend asks for loaves of bread and not more luxurious foods. So help us discover what Jesus might be teaching through this odd parable, I want us to travel to Sedaka, a small village in Malaysia, in order to learn from the experiences of contemporary peasants there. There's nothing extraordinary about Sedaka. It's a small 70-household village in Kedah, the main paddy-growing region in Malaysia. The entire community survives by farming rice. And like most rural villages in Malaysia, the majority of peasants cannot farm enough rice to support their family. Aside from a few wealthy families who own a massive amount of paddy land, most families do not own enough land to rise above the poverty level. In the last 50 years, since the green revolutions introduced new agrarian technologies to the farmers, peasant life in Sadaka has become more precarious. Double cropping, new seeds, fertilizers, and machines like combine harvesters have greatly affected peasant life. While now there is more food for everyone, unfortunately, these changes have only exacerbated the inequalities between the rich and the poor. This is definitely true in the small town of Sadaka, where for the last 50 years, the rich have gotten richer and the poor have remained poor or gotten even poorer. While the growing inequalities are troubling for this small village, what is really destroying the lives of the peasants there are the few wealthy individuals who are abandoning the common practices of the village in order to hoard more wealth and more land. The most notorious example of this is a man named Haji Ayub, or as nicknamed by the peasants, Haji Broom. During his lifetime, Haji Broom became the largest owner of paddy land that Kedah has ever known. At his death, he owned more than 400 acres of paddy fields. To put this in perspective, most peasants are quite lucky to own 2 acres. And any farmer that owns 6 acres or more is considered quite rich. Haji Broom is what we would today call a land grabber. In fact, he amassed so much land that the state assembly forbade him from acquiring any more. But what made the village of Sadaka despise Haji Broom was not his great wealth, but the ways in which he hoarded and accumulated his wealth. Haji Broom was not only greedy, he was stingy. His house was so run down that it was viewed as a collective embarrassment to the entire village. He ate the cheapest of foods and used the poorest of tobacco. And in times of distress, Haji Broom would never lift a finger to help his neighbors. All he wanted to do was obtain as much fortune as he could for himself. And yet, how he accumulated his wealth, that was even more disgraceful than his hoarding of it. Haji Ayub got the nickname Haji Broom due to the way that he swept up all the land in his path. And he had many tricks up his sleeve. He would lend a family a substantial amount of money in return for the title of all or part of their land, knowing full well that they would never be able to repay it on time. And so the contract stipulated that if they couldn't, he would take their land. However, if a peasant was fortunate enough to amass the money that they needed in time, Haji Broom had another trick. He would go into hiding a few weeks before the repayment date, and then 3 or 4 days afterwards, he would return and head straight to the courts and tell them that they haven't paid him money in time, as this contract stipulated. He had other tools in his toolbox as well, and all of them centered on one thing: exploiting neighbors in times of dire need. Haji Broom's immoral practices reminds me of a line from Woody Guthrie's song about the outlaw Pretty Boy Floyd. Some will rob you with a gun, and some with a fountain pen. What made Haji Broom so notorious? Why did the peasants dislike him more than any of the other wealthy landowners? He wasn't the only one. One peasant in Sadaka states the reason clearly. Haji Broom was a man without shame. As anthropologist James Scott highlights, being without shame, that's the ultimate accusation in peasant societies. Unlike in our culture, where shame is perceived negatively, where shame means being disgraced, flawed, or unworthy, shame has a positive connotation in peasant communities. Shame is the glue which holds the community together. It's what provides the social control, which ensures that all people act within the group's norms. Shame determines the core values, and then it mandates that all are supposed to act in keeping those values together. In peasant society, shamelessness It's when people do not care what other people think about them. And this is dangerous because shameless people, they flout convention and they disregard the expected behaviors, often to exploit the peasants. The Moroccan peasants have a saying which highlight this reality. Those who have no shame, they do as they please. Shameless people are people like Haji Broom, who disregarded the established codes of Sadakan life. He exploited the poor. He swept up their lands and he refused to offer aid in times of need. He was shameless because he didn't care about anyone but himself. Shame. Shame is the way in which peasants all over the world ensure that everyone acts within one moral code. A code that maintains that everyone should have the right to sustenance. A code that upholds traits like compassion, mutual aid, extravagant hospitality, and reciprocity as the bedrocks of community life. These traits help peasants know that in times of distress, that their family's well-being will be looked after and taken care of, because those times are going to come. These virtues also enable them to trust that the rich aren't going to excessively take advantage of them, and that they're going to take over their land. Resentment and criticism in peasant society, that only occurs when the rich and the poor alike aren't generous, when they do not practice charity, and when they do not entertain liberally. As long as you do that, it doesn't matter how much or how little wealth you have. Shame. That's how peasants construct community, which guarantees that people will come to your aid and provide sustenance in times of crisis. Traces of this understanding of shame, they still remain in our language today, don't they? When someone does something that's almost universally understood as immoral, like when a company rises prices on a drug overnight by thousands of percent, or when a border agent forces a 3-year-old child to choose which parent to deport and which that can remain, we still find ourselves saying to these people, you should be ashamed of yourself. This phrase reminds us that shame is still seen somewhere among us as a glue which keeps people, specifically the rich, in check. In our parable from Luke, I am convinced that Jesus is uplifting this virtue of shame, which is so foundational to peasant societies. For in the ancient Jewish world, there was the great tradition of a magnanimous host, which maintained that whenever a guest visited your house, the host was obliged to set a meal before their guests, and the guests were obliged to eat it, whether they were hungry or not. It didn't matter what time the guest arrived, the host must serve a meal and the guests must eat it. And as you might guess, this tradition was quite cumbersome and burdensome on the poor. So if a host couldn't fulfill this obligation, she was to call on the resources of the entire village, because hospitality was understood to be a requirement of everybody. The honor of the entire village was at stake whenever a visitor came among them. And because the entire village's honor was always at stake, everyone was expected to contribute to a meal if it was asked to them. In today's parable, we likely have a guest visiting the house of a poor peasant. In order to provide bread, and a substantial amount of bread at that, 3 loaves for a present, this friend must ask another friend for help. For anyone, not just a friend in peasant society, for anyone to deny this request, because one's children are in bed and the door is locked, that's an impossibility. The entire community would look down negatively upon them. That would be shameless. It would break the code. By failing to give bread in a time of a visitor's need, the neighbor would be viewed similarly to how the Tzedakans view Haji Broom. If a neighbor had any bread, they would know to instantaneously get up and contribute whatever they had. In our parable, we are told that the man ultimately arises because of his neighbor's persistence. But the word we'd use to translate it as persistence is very difficult to translate. And some scholars insist that the root of this word derives from the word shame. Another way of translating the verse is this: because of the man's shame, he will get up and give him as much as he needs. As Westerners, we have avoided this reading because we see shame negatively. But that's not true if we think of it through the lens of peasant societies. What if we see shame as the glue which holds communities together? What if we see it as a virtue which propels one to tend to one's friends and one's strangers alike? Then in our parable, we find Jesus promoting an ethic beyond friendship. And that's the ethic of shame, a virtue which calls us to provide help and aid and love whenever it is needed, no matter who is asking. In the parable, Jesus has this friend respond out of the spirit of shame instead of friendship to highlight that often friendship doesn't go far enough. Of course, friends will help out other friends in times of crisis. Of course, friends will provide bread so that another friend's visitors could eat. But what happens when a stranger, a foreigner, even if our enemies knock on our door in the middle of the night, will we dare get out of bed then? Friendship doesn't always care about everyone equally, does it? So Jesus uplifts something greater, the peasant code of shame, to insist that Christians are called to something different, to provide extravagant hospitality to everyone, no matter who it is. As itinerant ministers, Jesus and his disciples would have received radical hospitality from peasant villages on numerous occasions throughout his ministry. There's good reason to believe that Jesus himself is that midnight traveler who finds himself welcomed by a peasant in the middle of the night who has no food to offer. For Jesus and his disciples, they would have regularly found themselves staying wherever they could, and they would have been completely dependent on the hospitality of strangers in order to provide for their needs. And many of these visits, they would have strained their hosts and even the entire village. Feeding 13 people unexpectedly, that's quite cumbersome. In these instances, Jesus would have seen the peasant virtue of shame. He would have seen how strangers would have welcomed him and shared everything that they had in order to feed him and his friends. He would have witnessed how shame brings a community together, how it calls them to generously pool their resources so that they can provide a feast for these strange guests. Through our parable this morning, Jesus reminds us that while friendship is extremely important, it's often not enough. It's one thing to sacrifice our well-being in order to help our friends in times of need, to help our friends who are struggling to make ends meet. However, as God's people, we are called to go beyond friendship. For God calls us to practice hospitality, generosity, and mutual aid to our friends, our neighbors, and strangers alike. The way of God beckons us to continually redistribute our wealth, our food, and our gifts for the sake of protecting and caring for everyone. It demands that we open our lives, even our homes, to ensure that others' basic needs are met. And the reason we do this, the reason we generously open our lives to our neighbors and even our enemies, is because this is what our God is like. For generosity, that's what's highlighted in both of the prayers before and after this parable. First, we are reminded that God generously gives everyone their daily bread. And then afterwards, Luke tells us that when anyone asks God for a fish or for some eggs, the basic staples of any peasant's diet, God isn't going to provide poisonous gifts like snakes or scorpions. No, God is going to give them and us the gifts they need in order to survive. Through this parable, by referencing the peasant's virtue of shame, Jesus proclaims that God is calling us to do likewise. Rather than caving into the desire to hoard and accumulate like Haji Broom, rather than being stingy and caring for ourselves first, God expects that we will provide sustenance to others in their times of need. God desires for all of us to provide mutual aid and hospitality to our neighbors and strangers alike when they need help. And through these small acts of redistributing our wealth, our lives, or even three simple loaves of bread, we witness to a different order of relations, one molded by justice. Through these ordinary acts, we display God's new world among us, where there's enough for everyone, where everyone has a right to guaranteed sustenance, and where compassion and reciprocity are seen as the bedrocks to human flourishing. As Jesus said in other parables, let all of us who have ears to hear, let us hear. Amen.
For our hymn of, excuse me, for our hymn of response, I'm going to ask you to take out the hymnal packet sampler that should be in your pews. We're going to sing number 29, "Touch the Earth Lightly," which was new to me and maybe new to you. It's a fairly simple melody, and I don't know, I think pleasant and all that kind of thing. So I'm going to take a shot at singing it for you. I'll sing through the first verse. And then we'll start with verse 1 again, and I will invite you to join me. So, "Touch the Earth Lightly," number 29 in this packet.